A new Star Wars journey begins in the place all good journeys begin. At, well, the beginning. This Star Wars Day, I'm excited to introduce the new Star Wars Canon Timeline podcast, where we will piece together the complete story of that galaxy far, far away, in timeline order, from the dawn of the Jedi through the great unknown following the sequel trilogy. This is a podcast for both Star Wars superfans and complete newbies. Listen to the short intro episode now to hear how it works and what to expect over the coming weeks as we set the stage for the new television series The Acolyte, which we will be covering with weekly breakdowns. Subscribe to the Star Wars Canon Timeline podcast wherever you listen to take part in one of the most epic and expansive stories ever told, following all the twists and turns from start to finish. May the Fourth be with you all month and beyond.
What about my brand name?
Welcome to Properly Howard, a podcast that reviews classic films and other pulp fiction. Today we take a look at John Carpenter's The Thing. This is a remake of The Thing from Another World, which is not nearly as gory and has criminally less Wilford Brimley. Kurt Russell fights an alien life form that some pesky Norwegians unwittingly unleashed on the world. With me to discuss this film, as always, is Dr. Anthony Ladon.
Brimley without the mustache is a little disconcerting.
Oh, yeah. I mean, that's... I think that's why they went with it. I'm sure he came on set with the mustache and Carpenter's like, that's got to go.
Honestly, like, I would love to see him play more ping pong on screen. I didn't know that I was missing that in my life. As soon as I saw it, I thought, I hope that that's what this whole movie's going to be about. This underrated sports movie, The Thing, is going to be like a 20-year story arc where Brimley finally gets his mustache in the end.
He wins it back.
He starts with a very small tournament in Antarctica. Ends up going to China.
And... He loses his first match and they take his mustache as punishment. But he has to do this. It's a supernatural, it's sort of like Mortal Kombat, but it's ping pong as he's trying to get his mustache back. Thing pong is what we call it, Emily.
thing pong. How should we start? I mean, there's a lot of places we could start. I feel like
it's funny, like, you know how like the concept of the Mandela effect, where like you remember something like for certain a way that it wasn't. And I just watched this movie, and you just reiterated that Wilford Brimley did not have a mustache. And in my mind, I'm like, no, he had a mustache the entire time.
Really?
Because it's not natural. It's not a natural thing for him to not have a mustache. Like, it must have hurt to get it off.
So in order for your brain to avoid the trauma, you actually filled in the blank. You colored in the mustache in your imagination.
I don't think that thing comes off. I think they must have given him the Cesar Romero treatment from when he was the Joker, and they just painted over it.
Is that what they did?
Yeah, so the Joker in the Batman series always has his mustache is painted white to match his face. Because Cesar Romero wasn't going to shave his mustache for the role.
I love that they wanted him so much.
Could you imagine? Just think, like, this is a deal breaker. Like, well, I'll just paint it.
I guess if it was like, what other famous mustache is like Tom Selleck?
Which he shaves it off. I mean, it's like at that point you're like, well, this show's gonna tank.
They took off his mustache for Friends, and then it was sort of like, well, that's the end. This can only be the last season.
What's the thing? It's like that's such his thing, right? Like, and it's like when you see him without it, you're just like, all right, okay, now you're gonna just act, I guess. Nobody cares.
Do you feel like you have more affection for Kurt Russell or John Carpenter?
Ooh, that's a good question.
I was thinking, like, how do I begin this? What is your history with, you know, either one of these guys? And I thought, I wonder which Steve would prefer more.
I'm trying to think of my
Yeah, because I mean, obviously, there's so much Kurt Russell, so many of Kurt Russell's stuff that I like is because of a John Carpenter film,
Yeah,
and then
sure.
therefore, maybe my appreciation for Kurt Russell is because of those moments. But I'm trying to think of when the first time I ever saw Kurt Russell. It might not have been a Carpenter joint, though, because I mean, what's Big Trouble is that 87, 86?
It's late 80s for sure, and I feel like that probably is my first
So that's
exposure
86.
to Kurt Russell.
I did not see The Thing until like a couple years ago.
Really?
I did not see Escape from New York until you and I saw it together for the first time in preparation for Escape from LA.
Right. Yeah. So you
So,
didn't see The Thing. What prompted you to watch The Thing?
my son, it's one of his favorite movies of all time.
Really? And you had, and it's a Kurt Russell.
It's a Kurt Russell, John Carpenter film that he watched independent of me.
This is bizarre. This is the most sci-fi premise of this podcast so far. Wow.
Yeah, and it's on.
It's not only something, it's hard to believe. It's very difficult to believe. So this is my first viewing of The Thing. Just watched it last night for the first time. Rewatched probably the first half of it this morning. And then I also watched for the very first time Thing from the Outer Space. Oh, no. The Thing
From
from
another
Another
world,
World, 1951, which you might have watched for your horror class.
yeah. I watched some of that this morning, sort of skipping around, and I hadn't. I thought I had, but it was not on the list.
It's a interesting movie, I guess. I mean, I enjoyed it. It was sort of like about an hour in, I thought, am I still enjoying this or am I a little bit bored?
Yeah, I was as I was flipping through it, kind of skimming through it, and I'm like, oh yeah, I'd for sure be bored. And I understand that like filmmaking was different then, but and I'll let you continue, but I think that there's something about the remake. I mean, they're able to take those boring moments and do a whole lot more with it.
Yeah, it's 51, and it kind of begins as a classic World War II movie, really. It's like all of the characters that you would find in a World War II movie, except for they're not in Japan, they're not in Europe, they're near the North Pole. And you've got this wisecracking newspaper man and a couple, I don't know, sexy dames that they're kind of wisecracking themselves, and little kind of a side plot, like one of the military bigwigs has something for a secretary that happens to be in the middle of nowhere at this station. And I kind of enjoyed that. I kind of enjoyed that whole premise. And then I found out afterwards that the Carpenter joint follows the short story more closely. And the monster looks a little bit more like Frankenstein, and like sort of maybe an homage to the popularity of Frankenstein. And when Carpenter comes along, he decides he's going to, I guess the screenplay undergoes a couple iterations, but they decide to be a little bit more closely aligned with the short story, which was called Who Goes There. And the key difference is that in this 82 version, the monster's greatest power is that he can shapeshift. And he can take the form of someone and mimic you perfectly so that even your best friend can't tell that you're the monster. None of that is in the 51 iteration.
But is that in, and that's in the short story?
That is in the short story.
Oh, that's quite it. I mean, that's a significant choice.
It
Like
is,
that, to
and
me,
I,
you might make the argument that's the movie.
yeah, that is the reason for the remake. We've been talking this whole season, like, why do a remake? And here, Carpenter, he, I've seen an interview with him. He said he really was affected by seeing the 51 film in the theater. And then, so then, you know, so he had an affection for that movie. So why remake it? Well, this is a great reason why. One of the key features that makes it most interesting wasn't in the movie. And so he decided he's going to make it more closely aligned with the original short story. That is a great reason for a remake.
Right. No, that's great. Because we talk about like, why, what's the, like, is it a cash grab? Is it a this, is it a that? Like, it's like, there's a better story to be told and he gets to do it. So
I will say one more thing about the original thing from Another World. I think that it could almost be the original Alien. I feel like the film Alien, which is set in outer space, I feel like I could probably come up with a list of 20 things that the movie Alien borrows from A Thing from Another World. It's almost like Thing 82 is a remake of Who Goes There, or an adaptation of Who Goes There, whereas Thing from Another World's remake is actually the movie Alien.
That's interesting.
Anyway, tell me more about why you like this movie, Steve.
So it is, it's funny, like I said, that it took me so long to get to it. It's almost nonsensical considering the ingredients. So when I saw it, so obviously didn't see it in 82. I was busy watching E.T., I guess.
Or rewatching Star Wars.
Sure. So watching this later and hearing like, oh, you know, I'm like, I know I like John Carpenter. I know I like Kurt Russell. I know this is a now beloved horror film. So there was obviously some expectation. And I was excited because I had forgotten that I had, and I think we've talked about this during the Fly and American Werewolf in London, is that I used to collect Fangoria cards. This was one of those that I had. I would get in cards all the time, and like I had forgotten that where those images that were in my head were from. And so it was fun to see a lot of the effects, because they brought me back to my Fangoria card days. So there was a little bit of nostalgia for having recognized things.
What was the image that they chose for the Fangoria?
The ones that I had were the head, the upside down head.
The spider head?
Yeah, yeah. That, okay. And then one of, like, when the dog's head sort of opens up and the tongue's just hanging out.
Yeah, okay, I get
it. So it was really cool to have that. But I really, right out the gate, I was like, this movie is awesome. Like, it's just, it might be, and I haven't seen all of it, it might be Carpenter's best work.
It is his favorite that he's done.
It's incredible what he does. John Carpenter has an interesting career. Like, he almost exclusively makes cult classics, but you don't know that until like way after the fact. So like, what's he doing, right? Like, what is he doing that isn't appreciated enough at the time? You know what I mean? Like that's a significant it's a significant trick to pull off at all, much less repeatedly. So it's an odd thing that he's able to do this, and then you have to do like, upon further review, this is great.
But couldn't it be, I mean, it's sort of like, is it Bill Walsh or is it Joe Montana or whatever? But I feel like some of that has to do with Kurt Russell. I mean, you could almost say that he exclusively does cult classics as well.
Potentially, yeah. I mean, Tombstone is certainly not a cult classic. It's considered beloved.
It was loved at the time for sure.
Yeah. I think part of it is there is a B-movie quality that John Carpenter brings that isn't due to like a lack of talent. You know, like some B-movies are like, oh, you don't have the budget, you don't have the this, you don't have the that, so you create this B-movie. Like, I think it's an affection. Mm-hmm. So I think he sees these films through a lens that he really enjoys, And I think people don't know how to enjoy it maybe right out the gate in many cases. I know that this got a lot of like really bad reviews when it first came out because it was just so gory, and it was, they were like, it's nihilistic, it's boring, it moves slow, and if there's no positive outcome here, it's just, it's bleak. And I mean, I can't imagine that that was that rare in 82, but I guess compared to the aforementioned E.T., it certainly doesn't have that same vibe.
Well, it's funny. It's funny how things have turned, because I feel like it seems like the opposite of that could be a reason to not like a movie or pan a movie now. Like, it's
right. Oh, it's too Hollywood.
Yeah, right. It does
too, you know, happy ending. Yeah,
too much of a Pollyanna Shandine or something. It's funny that you say B-movie quality, because I was going to ask you if Kurt Russell was your favorite B-movie actor.
Mm, interesting. Yeah, I mean, he's definitely like, Kurt Russell's fantastic to watch, because it's like, he clearly has a John Wayne influence, and but it's way more like charming. And he just
has that. He has that quality, is that charismatic quality, even when he's doing nothing.
Yeah. And, well, his eyes are, he has storytelling eyes. It's really something.
And this movie, I was kind of surprised, maybe his most subtle.
Yeah.
Acting. Like, I haven't seen everything he's been in for sure, but he doesn't kind of ham it up. There's that first scene where he is playing chess with the chess wizard computer.
Yeah.
And you get that little glimpse of, yeah, Kurt Russell, I'm going to like this. But he kind of doesn't ham it up for the rest of the film.
I think that's one of the positives of this film, is everybody plays it pretty well. Like, I mean, I buy it. Like, I buy a lot of, like, this, they're isolated. And then once it's just a movie about paranoia, like, the Carpenter has a very deft hand on being patient, mm-hmm. in between, like, a big, I mean, and like, there's big scenes in this, you know, especially from an 82 perspective, and the amount of like graphic effects that are going on. I mean, this is a lot, right, for 82. And it's not subtle when it comes to the effects, but then the rest of the movie is really like played softly. It's really it's such an interesting directorial choice that he does. Like, I mean, it just, when the creature shows up, it's just mayhem, and it is gory, and the sounds are so intense, and mm-hmm. then you get back to being isolated again, right? And I really just think that it's such a good job, because you do, like, you start getting more tense about the paranoia than you do when the alien shows up.
And if you're going to try to do that with a film, the score has to be spot on.
Yeah.
And we were just talking about Cape Fear and how the score kind of almost ruined that film.
Mm.
This is the exact opposite. So much of this film is about the anticipation of what's around the corner. Not that it fails to deliver when it wants to get gory or whatever, but it really is a psychological thriller as much as it is a slasher. And if you're going to do that, if it's going to be a psychological thriller, you are going to lean heavily on the score. And I thought this was almost the perfect score for this film.
Well, that's what I love about Carpenter doing his own music too. Like, it adds, like, I mean, it's such a, you don't see that, right? I don't know of any other directors that will do the music as well. And, and it's, so it's like, he gets to really control the narrative, right? Not only visually, but audibly. And I think that's a pretty cool spot to be in. And it's so like the same thing with like Escape from New York, the doo doo doo.
Yeah.
Boom, boom, boom. Like, there's, like, he knows how to have some fun with it. I mean, he even made the song Big Trouble in Little China, which is a lovely music video if you haven't had the chance to watch that. He's just so, like, I think, like, there's a certain amount of fun that happens too, I think, when in a Carpenter film. And this is one of those ones that where it's like, it's not fun, but it still is. Like, it's a ride, you know, it's, I don't know. It's a real fascinating thing to break down a Carpenter flick. Because, I mean, like, he's got other movies like Starman and, you know, which has got a totally different vibe. But that's entertaining. But it has there's some bleakness, even though that one has a little bit more of a positive overall tone. But this has just got like, there's no joy here. But unlike Cape Fear, which was joyless, this is still somehow fun.
Well, I do get a fair amount of joy with a movie that begins with someone hanging out of a helicopter shooting a machine gun at a wolf. Like, there, for me, it's like perfectly encapsulates 1982. The kind of entertainment that I would have been interested in 82. Give me one of those bulbous helicopters flying low to the ground, a Norwegian hanging out the side door with a machine gun. I mean, it's a great way to start a movie.
Yeah, it is. It's one of those movies. Like, I won't say like it's perfect, but in terms of what it's trying to do, it's done about as well as you could imagine. You know what I mean? It's like, I'm reading reviews at the time and versus, you know, much later when people like have had a chance to kind of go back and they kind of do like a mea culpa. We're like, no, this is maybe one of the greatest horror films of all time. You know, and it's amazing how like that's the shift. The shift was, this is junk. This is unnecessary. This is a waste of time. This is bleak. To like, now you have people going, this is the quintessential horror film. It's amazing. It's DNA is in a bunch of other movies, you know, like that happened after. I think that's a fascinating turn, right? And it, like, even to the point where Carpenter was pulled from other projects because of the poor reception for this film. He was supposed to direct Firestarter, and they pulled him from it. They actually, I think they had, I forget, it was a multi film deal that he signed with Universal, I think, after the success of Halloween, because he had done Escape from New York the year before, and so they just bought him out. They bought him out of that of the deal. And he talks about it. He's all, you know, here I make this movie that's like now, well, revered and thought of to be as this, like, not just good, but like a classic, right? Like, mm-hmm. And he says how much different his career might have been. You know, he's all, I love making Starman and Christine and Big Trouble in Little China. He's like, but I just can't help but think, like, what would my career have been had this been received the way it is now back then?
Well, maybe it wouldn't have been as good.
And that's possible, right? Maybe he gets more of the making those Hollywood films that we just talked about, where would have been criticized more now, as opposed to, you know, having people who believe in him make, you know, give him a green light to make a movie.
Right. Yeah. Now, I don't think that this is a perfect movie. I mean, there are a couple things that were pretty I laughed out loud a couple times. There's this one moment where Richard Dysart, mm-hmm. he's the guy from L.A. Law.
Right.
Like he's trying to protest, you know, being set apart or tied up or something. And he just has this comically bad line read. There's also the problem with the Norwegian. He's trying to throw a grenade and it it just slips out of his hand and goes backwards.
Hey, man.
It was really, really bad. I mean,
I don't know. I'm like, yeah, that probably could happen to me.
That's what it's the only possible thing that would happen if I was handling a grenade.
I went bowling a month and a half ago and I injured my finger and it has not healed. I would for sure drop a grenade behind me.
It looks so bad. It looks so bad. But I'm nitpicking. This is a great movie, and this is the kind of movie that I absolutely wouldn't have watched even 4 years ago. Just just no interest in the horror genre, and now I kind of see that I was missing out on some really great films.
Yeah. No, no, for sure. And I as we've discussed over and over, because of your sort of you know, your little journey into the horror genre, and like in the idea that, like, well, at I think even going into it, it was kind of like, at best, these will be like guilty pleasures, as opposed to like, oh, there's actually some really good stuff going on, and there are stories you can tell in the horror genre. And like, and especially with this, we talk about like science fiction and how they tend to deal oftentimes in allegory. Horror can do a little bit of that too. And I just love how the horror in this movie, like I mentioned, I'm like, it's, yeah, the thing, the alien is grotesque, and my gosh, we've got to kill it with fire. But the not knowing is the real scary part of this, of this movie, right? I mean, it's like, cause you mean, well, maybe MacReady really is the alien the whole time, you know? Like, there is those, that there's a good chunk of that where, like, we don't know. Like, you don't know.
Yeah, I feel like we ought to talk about the ending. So, I was thrilled by the ending, and I think that the reason why is that when he finally blows up the alien, I was set to be really disappointed the ending, because when he blows up the alien at the end and walks outside, I just kind of thought that was kind of underwhelming.
Right.
Didn't really do much for me. And then he goes and sits outside and Childs comes up, and then I realize, oh, they're going to do something different. And not only do they underplay the ending, they leave the ending open-ended.
Yeah.
So
I love it.
You are wondering, did the alien win? And which one of these two is the alien? Or I guess another reading, my least favorite reading would be, neither one of these guys is the alien. But I don't know. How do you understand the ending here?
I think that's the whole point. I don't think the ending is supposed to be known. And because that's the whole movie. The whole movie is you're trying to figure out who is and who isn't. And even if they aren't, for how long, right? Like, I mean, it's because, you know, I love how they actually, you know, you forget that Childs is not a part of this. Because he was the one back at the station while they were gonna go and you know, deal with this, and then they just sort of just forget about it. So it's like, well, we don't know how many, because that's the thing about the alien, right? Like, there's blood, that's part of it. It's all over, and then if it blows up, like, you don't know if any piece of that hit MacReady or not, and. I think the whole point is, like, it ends right where it began, essentially. And they either kill each other, one is the alien or one is a human, or they just kill each other. They could kill each other as humans out of paranoia. Like, so that tension just stays, and, you know, or your other alternative, like you said, is less interesting, where they're both humans, but they probably both just die. They're just probably going to freeze to death.
Yeah. The thing that's interesting is that Childs comes out, says, "Where were you? Got lost in the blizzard. Then I found my way back." And what do we do now? Well, let's just sit here and see what happens next. And then MacReady shares his whiskey bottle with Childs. And at that moment, in my mind, I'm thinking back, wait, they decided early in the movie to do their own food because they want to make sure that, you know, no little even molecule of the alien could, you know, contaminate their food. And so Childs takes a drink out of his bottle. So they're swapping saliva. And either, so, and then MacReady laughs. Does he laugh because he's the alien and he thinks, "I gotcha"? Or does MacReady laugh because he thinks, "Ah, I know that the real child would not have accepted it.
Yeah.
Yeah, would not have accepted a swig from my bottle. Now your secret is revealed, and that's why he laughs. So it could work either way. And my initial thought was it's probably child's is probably the alien, but it after sort of second, third thought, it really leaves it open-ended in a very satisfying way.
Yeah. No, and I think that's to me is like, this is a major bummer that this movie was not as well received, because I mean, I could totally see from Carpenter's standpoint, it's like, ah, look what I did. Mm-hmm. look at how I ended it. Like in terms of like a horror film. And I don't love the idea that a lot of these critics are blasting it for being bleak. I'm like, well, also like, look at the genre. Look at what is the movie trying to do? Like, I couldn't even imagine then if this movie turned out and we're like, MacReady's getting the Medal of Honor for saving the world. Like, is that what you want? Like, after that?
Yeah, you got to give a medal to him and his pilot buddy and one of the dogs.
I mean, it's goofy to think that there's a... Like, to me, that ending is... I mean, it's such a perfect ending for the movie you just made, mm-hmm. right? Like... It's like, I actually, when I first saw it, I just figured he blew up with it and it was it. And then I had the same feeling as you did when the first time I saw it. I'm like, oh, this feels a lot like the ending of Predator. Obviously, Predators later were just like, oh, okay, champion of the monster.
Mm-hmm.
But that's not the case. And even if it is, we don't know. And then there's no peace for them, right? Like, that's the thing, is this movie ends with no peace.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's just a great ending to a really, like I said, it's bleak, but it's still a fun ride.
Is there a cliche, a device or a trope that you enjoyed in this movie?
Oh, I mean, it's amazing how many there are, right? Like, there's a lot of, especially for like horror and science fiction tropes, there's just so many that are on display, yet it never feels trite. And maybe some of it is like 82. Maybe there was some ground being broken that we, you know, I don't appreciate.
Very kind of just primal elements. I mean, just like, it comes down to fire and dynamite and a blood test. It really brings it down to basics. You know?
Yeah. I'm trying to think of a movie, and this might be the answer to your question. I can't think of a movie where a flamethrower makes it worse.
A flamethrower. This movie's got a helicopter and a flamethrower, a big old roll of dynamite.
Oh yeah, lots of dynamite.
What else do you want? You throw those ingredients in with Kurt Russell, you have me every time.
He just kills the dad from License to Drive, and it's like, I love that. I love the idea that they reveal later that he was a human. Like, I think that's such a key element of the movie, and that's a brave move, you know, for, you know, that's a brave choice to make, right? I mean, your hero killed a guy.
Yeah, I like the guy who's in charge of the dogs kind of looks a little bit like a dog himself.
Yeah, he's got that little hangdog kind of look, and
which makes you like him. It's like, yeah. I like dogs, and
he had sex with the dogs, but I mean, like, you just know that. And no, and Carpenter does, could, and Carpenter does well. Carpenter does well to not like overdo it. Like, he's like, you know, this guy has sex with these dogs. Like, he's just, it's that's why he's so sad.
That's why he has to die.
Yeah, it was actually fine. Like, he knows something.
Was there a tweak that you would make to improve this movie?
I don't think so. I'm sure you could do something a little different, right? I mean, I will say that, like, I think these effects are amazing even now. I mean, they're clearly not, like, you know, it's not a thing that's happening, right? You know what I mean? It's like, but it's like, I was so enamored by the effects and able to go, well, this is pretty great for 82. I was actually surprised it didn't take me out of the movie, because, like, you know, as soon as you start thinking of it as a movie, you can get taken out of it. But I was like, I was so fascinated by like the stretching of faces and all of that. I would say that maybe the one thing would maybe the moment when he puts his hands through the guy's stomach. and it chomps him. Those teeth were too big.
Like those are like Muppet teeth. Like those are like jack-o'-lantern teeth.
Yeah, those are jack-o'-lantern teeth. Like if it was like a bunch of smaller, sharper teeth, I think that scene is a lot more powerful, because that was the one point where I'm like, that was a choice.
I only came up with two things, and one is the grenade thing. I just thought, oh no. Come on. You gotta do that better. You gotta like accidentally, it drops to your foot and then your foot just something about that. The other thing is that the color of the blood is always an interesting choice to me. Mm-hmm. It feels like the more bright it is, it feels like the more comical the movie is going to be. Mm. Like Evil Dead 2, it's almost pink or whatever.
Yeah, yeah.
And if it's like kind of like a horror-y, it's going to be sort of a bright color. I felt like the blood was a little bit too corn syrupy sometimes.
Yeah, and you wonder if that's just the way it was, or if that was a choice because of maybe the lack of color in the rest of the film. Afraid that maybe it would just kind of gray out.
And of course, I don't have the history with horror that other people do, so I don't know if this is like, dude, measured by 82, this was like really, really good.
Yeah, really quite great. Possibly, right? How good is Brimley in this, by the way?
Oh my gosh. I was wondering, like, after watching him in this film, I thought, he's a legit fantastic actor.
Yeah, right?
And maybe it's the mustache. Maybe it's like, no, this is what his career would have been like if he had grown the mustache or something.
Well, we're like, we grew up, I mean, I don't know your first Brimley, but I mean, what, like?
Quaker Oats commercials.
Quaker Oats, Our House, and Cocoon. Those are the big three, right? So his role, like, in my opinion, he only came into the universe to be an old guy that had advice. Eat your oatmeal. And like.
Well, and I used to watch Lonesome Dove, and so I'd like to see him on a horse every now and again.
Yeah, I mean, and so it was nice to journey back. And you messaged me saying that Wilford Brimley is younger than you in this movie, right?
I really, at that moment, I thought I should just die.
Well, I felt the opposite. Like when you said that, and I a lot of times I'll look at myself and I'll go, gosh, you know, I really wish this was different. This was different. I wish I was aging better in this way. And then you see Wilford Brimley and I'm like, dude, I'm doing all right. I'm doing all right. Like if Wilford Brimley was at my class reunion, I'd be like, good God, why are teachers here?
Oh my gosh. I don't know I haven't looked at his filmography. I don't know if this is one of the earlier movies that he did.
I want to see his baby picture. There's no way this guy was ever young.
this is what he looked like at 16.
Yeah, 16 years old, probably like 8 years old with a full mustache, receding hairline.
It's like the reverse of a child actor. You know, child actors who famously play 14 until they're 24 or whatever.
Right.
This guy was playing 44 at 12.
Yeah. His first movie was alongside Kurt Russell where he played his dad. It was computer, wore tennis shoes, and he was like 16 to Kurt Russell's 12.
I love watching Brimley destroy those computers.
Oh, it's just everything he did was amazing. Like it was so like, and that thing is he's real convincing. He plays essentially three characters, right? Or maybe four, right? He's the wise scientist.
Yeah.
And then he.
You wouldn't normally cast him in that role, right?
Right. Well, I wouldn't know if I'd cast him in any of these four roles.
Do you want when you want Brimley? You want someone who's folksy. You want a folksy cowboy or something.
So he's the wise scientist. He becomes the paranoid, anarchist.
Yeah.
Then he becomes the sad sack apologetic. No, man, I don't want to be alone.
Let me back in.
And then he becomes the villain, the alien villain. Uh-huh. I mean, and he does each one just super convincingly. It's crazy to me how, like, don't sleep on Brimley's range. Well, he could have played every single character in The Breakfast Club and it would have been perfect.
I was joking about the ping pong thing before, but he's legitimately good at ping pong. You could just tell. It's like it's not like this is his first game of ping pong.
Carpenter's like, you know, we're going to keep a ping pong scene in there because it's like people got to watch.
Because they had a pool table and he was like, you know, if you really want to do this right, bring me a ping pong table.
Don't be bringing me no air hockey. No way they're playing air hockey up this far north.
I love that these guys, like, this is exactly the kind of, I don't know what they're doing. I don't know if that's part of canon. Like, why are they up there? What are they studying? It never gets discussed, right?
Right.
Like, we know that the Norwegians are tinkering with extraterrestrials or whatnot, but why are the Americans up there? As far as we know, they're listening to Stevie Wonder, playing pool, cards.
Roller skating.
Roller skating, playing ping pong. That's what I'm talking about.
You're describing a movie that sounds insane. And then you watch this and you're like, yeah, no, this is great. Roller skating one day, you're killing your friend the next. I love this movie.
And drinking copious amounts of Jim Beam.
Just drinking. Like crazy. I think that's an amazing thing, right? This movie, because it shows too that like they're all so tight knit and but they're on this thing for so long that they're already a little stir crazy.
They're on each other's nerves for sure. I love the scene where like the guy that looks like Louis C.K.'s older brother comes out and yells, "Can you turn that down? I just got shot today."
I know.
Like, it's enough that I was shot by a stray Norwegian bullet. Now I've got to listen to Stevie Wonder at all hours.
See, the mistake that they made when making the 2011 The Thing, which apparently is a prequel focusing on the Norwegians.
Oh, interesting.
And it was pretty panned, and I don't think it's going to be it's going to be reviewed as a classic. I haven't seen it. I was actually more interested in it when I thought it was a remake, less interested in the prequel concept. I could potentially take a look-see. The prequel should have just been those guys getting on each other's nerves. No threat of aliens.
This could have easily been a sitcom for sure.
Oh man, that'd be a great idea. You just create the Thing prequel miniseries, and it's just a bunch of guys that start off really enjoying each other until eventually they just get on each other's nerves. And then the next, like the final episode is they hear a Norwegian shooting.
Steve, is this movie better, worse, or on par with a Ron Howard film?
It's a Howard plus four for me.
Wow. That's a lot higher than I was going to say.
I'm just saying, I just think there are the management of the effects, right? This could have easily been a movie that's like we're going to focus on the effects. We have these really cool things. Granted, there's plenty of scenes where those effects take center stage, but to have the directorial hand that says, no, I know that the real terror is the not knowing. And so I'm still going to handle those sequences with the same level of detail and attention, if not more, because it's like Carpenter knows the effects are going to do what they're going to do. I don't have to do as much on those scenes because the effects are going to take that. But I'm going to get you in the mind of a maniacal Wilford Brimley. That's, you know, good luck, Ron Howard. You're great, but you can't do that.
I was going to say Howard plus one. And for most of the film, it was properly Howard. And then the ending just ticked it up that one last notch. And it could be that, you know, I'll revisit the film from time to time and it will climb. But, this film has had to grow on me a little bit.
Gotcha.
I will say, though, Steve, that you know my feeling about filming in snowy regions and wearing hats. I feel like Kurt Russell knew that this is going to be an issue for me, and he decided that he was going to wear a sombrero.
That sequence is like,
I mean, if I'm always asking for hats in the snow, this is like a guy saying, all right, I'm gonna wear the biggest floppiest sombrero I can find
on top of like my hood. It's so funny.
This is my helicopter pilot hat that I always wear when I fly helicopters in America. It's a big floppy sombrero.
And it could be that I am, you know, so pro Carpenter and so pro Kurt Russell that I'm like, I never was once taken out because of that. In fact, if anything, I'm like, dude, of course MacReady has that hat. Of course he has that
hat. It's a legit Speedy Gonzalez hat.
Because it's a hat where it's like, where I could see him showing up at the first day. Like, I feel like I got a backstory, right? He shows up at the base and he's like, and he puts that hat on. They're like, what are you doing? Hey, we're going to be in the snow for an awful long time. Doesn't mean I got to dress like it. How about a little taste of the tropics, huh?
Then
he just insists on wearing that hat all the time.
I feel like he grew the beard just to match the hat. Like, if I'm going to wear, I've been waiting to wear this hat in the film, but I think it works better if I have a big bushy beard. Does he ever have a big bushy beard in any other films?
Oh, I would definitely say the where he's Santa Claus.
Yes, you're right.
It'd be weird if he didn't.
I forgot that he was Santa Claus.
Christmas Chronicles.
Also North Pole.
He's got a beard in Bone Tomahawk.
Okay. Well, maybe it was just Brimley's mustache. They just shaved off the mustache.
And like the alien finding a new host.
And it just glommed on to Russell's chin. Does this movie have a half of the battle won de Grand moment?
Trust no one. Kill your friends.
I would just say no one needs to know what's going on in Norway. With Norwegians. Like, let the Norwegians do what they're doing.
I think the movie was quite the opposite.
We have no idea what's going on with Norway or Norwegians. That's the way it should be. Leave the Norwegians alone.
I think this is the exact opposite message. I'm going to have to disagree with you because I think this is the exact lesson. This is what happens when you leave the Norwegians to their own devices. Keep an eye on the Norwegians, all right? If they say they're going to go somewhere and they're going to be on their own little private mission, go, no, 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 you're not. We're sending a chaperone.
Norwegians need to be chaperoned at all times.
Norwegians can't be trusted.
Steve, we got an iTunes review I could read. And
okay, is it bad?
I don't know. It's a 5-star. I don't really know. I mean, maybe you can help me interpret this. The title is "Don't Be Like Me." It's 5 stars, and it's from Judge Tempest. Here's what Judge Tempest writes: although I wrote a review a long time ago. Make sure you do this small favor for a great quality podcast. Thanks for the laughs and insights. So that sounds good, right?
Sure.
Why don't be like me then?
Well, maybe there's two separate concepts, right? Like, hey, this is a great podcast. Also, my life's a mess.
So the title,
like, you have an opportunity, right? Like, you have one, like, you have, like, you're like, look, I'm on the internet. I've got somebody's attention, right? Got our attention. So maybe it's just for us. Like, maybe there's something about Judge Tempest mm-hmm. that specifically, like, maybe Judge Tempest is one of us from the future. And we're trying, and we make a choice that leads to something awful. And he's like, mm-hmm. you know what? I can't just show up to their place because they'll be freaked out because I'll be an older version of one of them. Mm-hmm. So if I speak to their narcissism directly by giving them a 5-star review, I know they're going to watch this. They're going to take a look at it.
I feel like this is a hostage situation. And although
it's a code.
Although the message looks like they're taking great care of me, but there's something in the title that if you knew the code, you'd be able to break it and be like, here are my coordinates.
So we're actually being used right now, I think. There's nothing to do with our podcast, is that this is...
Uh-huh. Or it's both. It's that you're being held hostage by me in the future.
Ah, oh, I like that.
I don't know what value your life has and why I would decide to hold you hostage. Anyway, Judge Tempest, thank you for writing a 5-star review. I think people should try to emulate this. I feel like we appreciate these reviews, especially 5-star reviews. We absolutely appreciate titles to these reviews that make us think. And you've done that for us today.
Don't sell yourself short, Judge Tempest. I think you're doing fine.
Okay. And then we got a couple emails. Both of these...
Till we read tomorrow that like Judge Tempest is like, he's just like the worst person ever. And you're like, well, you tried. I mean, they have one good redeeming quality, right? I mean, like, he can't be the worst person ever.
Judge Tempest is Jim Jordan.
I love the idea. Rolling up his sleeves, listening to our podcast. Get some fired up.
Okay, I got two emails. They both have to do with seeing you and your physical person, Steve.
Oof.
Yeah. The first one is, when do we get to see a photo of Steve's bitchin' Teen Wolf tattoo? It's from Peter.
Nice.
So do you want to answer Peter?
I guess I could put something on the old Instagram.
How people follow you on the gram?
They can follow me at Ozfest, AUSFEST. It's like Ozzy's festival, but
not
way more tame. Yeah, but very different. Yeah.
Now, I haven't asked you this, but I've been wanting to know: did your tattoo heal well?
So far, so good. Yeah, I don't like I don't know when to stop like being careful with it. Cause I think like the surface of it is healed. I think it takes like months for like all underneath to be all good.
So you're
like
still putting on the ointment.
Still putting on a little bit of ointment.
You'll
keeping
be 95 and the only part of your skin that hasn't aged is the Teen Wolf tattoo.
It's just going to be this, which is kind of the goal. Like I said, open casket, sleeveless.
You can pass it down to your son.
Yeah, exactly. So I don't know when to stop taking care of it. I talk to some people like, oh, you just sort of stop whenever, you know, it's fine. And that's an approach. I know that with the size and the amount of color in the ink, you know, I think it requires a little more tending to. But it's,
you're kind of in a unique situation. I feel like people that have tattoos with your level of detail usually going in phases.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they'll do at least 2 or 3 phases of the tattoo. And so it'll heal at least a little bit before the.
Yeah.
But you got it all at the same time. In my mind, and I just assumed that this was the case, is that when you took off the saran wrap, half of your skin just fell off. And now you're on the wrong coast to have it fixed. And you've just kind of been walking around dejected with a Teen Wolf's head clean off of your body. But apparently that didn't happen.
Well, it's sort of, I did kind of feel like I was a newspaper and the saran wrap was silly putty.
So.
That was me. Oh. I just texted, that little whistle was me texting you the picture of the wrap after it came off my arm.
Oh, for a second, I thought this was the arm. And I was going to be very concerned.
Yeah. That's like, it's
you're the thing? Are you the thing, Steve?
That's the shroud of Jay Fox.
Wow. That's disconcerting for sure. Because that's like your pus. This is a piece of art.
It's ink. And
this
pus.
Is a piece of art that was rendered by your pus. And I mean, it's colored pus.
Yeah. Now you get it.
That's That's disgusting. Not happy about seeing your discarded wrap. Now, did you keep it? I'm assuming it's discarded, but...
It is discarded because it's disgusting.
I would have been tempted to keep it.
Yeah, it's the grossest fruit roll-up you've ever encountered.
All right, I'm gonna try this again. Nolan has written to ask. He says he lives on the East Coast. He wants to know if either of us would be doing a live show that he could attend. I said that I will not. However, you are doing stand-up in New York soon.
Mm-hmm.
So why don't you tell Nolan about
it? Yeah, I will be for sure doing a show in Brooklyn on the 26th of October. That'll be, gosh, what is the name of the place? It's a bar show.
Have you put it on steveosburn.com yet?
Not yet. It's at the Talon Bar. I will as we get closer. I only put like maybe a week and a half.
So the Talon Bar in Brooklyn, New York.
Yeah.
9
p.m. Working on maybe something at the Greenwich
on
Club.
October 26th.
That's the 26th.
And you might possibly be elsewhere as well, but yeah. This one is for sure.
This is for sure. I've got a couple irons in the fire, and that'll all be, as we get closer, it'll all be updated on steveosburn.com.
And I will say, Nolan, that I will be there too. I will be sitting in the back. I will have ordered both of my drinks of the 2-drink minimum at the same time. So I'll be the bald guy in the back with the 2 drinks, maybe passed out. But if you can try to wake me up and introduce yourself if you're there.
Yeah, could we do it? We should do a live podcast somewhere if anybody wants to host us in New York.
But if it's not New York, then you're out of luck. Because I refuse to do any live podcasts that are not in New York City.
I get it. No, it's good to have a line where you draw.
It has to be in New York City. It has to be at the end of October. Those are my 2 conditions. I don't know. I don't feel like I would ever enjoy doing a live podcast.
Oh, I've done them. They're fun.
Yeah, sure. But like, here's my feeling. And I enjoy a podcast, I've already decided that I'm in for the format that they're using.
Okay. Yeah.
And then, so let's say it's one of my favorite podcasts, you know, click play to hear this week's podcast. And then I hear like the crowd wooing.
Mm-hmm.
All of a sudden I feel like, this wasn't what I was expecting.
You don't like live albums of bands you like.
In fact, I don't like concerts at all. Whenever I go to a concert, I think, you know, that I would prefer to be home listening to a radio right now in 1982.
That's because you hate people.
I don't want to see what the band has become after all this time. I do like live comedy. I don't know. I don't know what that says about me.
Well, that tends to be a little bit more infectious, I think, the laughter, and you know, you might hear a joke or something that you may never hear again. Whereas, you know, bands usually have their set list, right? I mean, that's kind of where it's going to go. So, I mean, I guess I think there is a difference. People are sitting and maybe a little more polite. People are getting used.
Maybe that's it. Maybe if I could sit during the concert,
and then people bring food and drink to you, as opposed to you having to get up and navigate a sea of people.
Steve will probably post something about his New York tour,
such as it is,
on steveosburn.com. Oh, and Steve has indeed made, I don't know if it was a promise, but he's considering posting his tattoo on Instagram.
Yeah. I mean, it's funny. I not a bunch of people know I have it. It's not something that it's an odd thing. Because it's like, I'm happy with it. I'm really proud of it. I don't wear a sleeveless shirt. So it's kind of one of these things where it's like, the question is like, well, who's it for? Though I did go sleeveless the other night when we did like our Mystery Science Theater type thing for the movie Over the Top. We all decided to go sleeveless for that.
Oh.
a cocoon of horror.
A new Star Wars journey begins in the place all good journeys begin. At, well, the beginning. This Star Wars Day, I'm excited to introduce the new Star Wars Canon Timeline podcast, where we will piece together the complete story of that galaxy far, far away, in timeline order, from the dawn of the Jedi through the great unknown following the sequel trilogy. This is a podcast for both Star Wars superfans and complete newbies. Listen to the short intro episode now to hear how it works and what to expect over the coming weeks as we set the stage for the new television series The Acolyte, which we will be covering with weekly breakdowns. Subscribe to the Star Wars Canon Timeline podcast wherever you listen to take part in one of the most epic and expansive stories ever told, following all the twists and turns from start to finish. May the 4th be with you all month and beyond.